Welcome to Holland Village. Today is Wednesday, June the 23rd, 1999. In the fireside room this evening is Mary Lowe. The session is called The Doctrine of Sin and Feminist Theology, Pride and Powerlessness. Let's listen in.
If you're going to harass, please sit up in the balcony. Having been a balcony harasser myself, I can appreciate that. I'm just going to introduce myself while people walk in and get settled. Thanks for coming. It's always hard to zip down here after a good dinner in the sunshine, especially since it's been raining on and off. For those of you who it's your first time in one of this series of sessions, my name is Mary Lowe, and I'm a doctoral student at the Graduate Theological Union of Berkeley, California, and been up to Holland a couple times, short-term, long-term, and once as a guest. So I figured the only week I haven't seen here is the last week of August. Mm-hmm. Other than that, I've done almost the whole year. And it's really I'm just thrilled to be here tonight. So thanks for coming. Tonight we're going to talk about feminist theology and sin. And I'm really excited because I like sin generally, but I really like this new stuff. And it's new to me, so I'm very excited about it and have a lot of energy. What's been working well in the sessions is to do a little brainstorming together as a class and kind of get the sin wheels spinning. And then I'll do a little introduction to feminist theology. And for some of you, you could probably give it now because this will be your third session. And then we'll move into what sin has looked like in the dominant theological tradition in the West, and then what some feminists have said about that. Okay, so we're going to start. Before we do our brainstorming, one of the things I always like to do is say why this is important. Why are we talking about sin? A lot of people don't like to talk about sin at all, and here I am willing to spend a whole hour of your life and mine talking about it. Some of the things are consistent with what I've said earlier in the week, which is largely in Christian history, women have been portrayed as the temptress, the first to sin, and the one who tempted man, Adam, the first man, to sin. And another point that's important is Christian anthropology has inherited Greco-Roman anthropology, which considers women to be closer to nature. They're more fleshy. They're warmer. They're closer to nature, more likely to sin. Another really important reason, raised by Mary Potter Engel, she says, and I quote, "I have chosen to focus on evil and sin, for it is this doctrine that continues to be the most powerful tools in the church's collusion with society, in the victimization of women, children, and elders." And finally, our understanding of sin is important, because if women are seen as the temptresses, more likely to sin, more likely to lead men into sin, then they're a little less worth saving, okay? Mm-hmm. There's less value placed on women. There's plenty of seats over here, so don't be afraid to walk in front of me. I'll keep talking no matter what happens. So that's why we're going to talk about this. Okay, so now I'm going to ask you to do a little brainstorming with me. And I would like you to shout out sins. There's no right or wrong answer. We're going to get some sins on the board. Somebody tell me a sin.
Greed. Gluttony.
All right, after dinner. All right, what's another one?
Pride.
What?
Pride.
Pride. Ooh, that will be one of our themes for the night. It's Enid,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You got that one. Somebody else said another.
Theft.
Theft.
Adultery.
Okay.
Murder.
Okay.
Lust
from the balcony. Okay.
Anxiety.
Pastoral sin.
Lying.
Okay.
Idolatry.
Okay, I got idolatry.
Deceit.
Covetousness.
Anger sometimes.
Okay, that's something we're going to talk about a lot, too. Okay, why don't we get two, three, or four more up here?
Sloth.
It really sets in about the third day up here, too. More sin.
Self-centeredness.
The pastor speaks. All right, one more good sin.
Abuse.
Abuse. All right, we're going to talk about that too.
Misspelling.
Which one did I misspell? This one?
Second line, second verb.
Oh, adult. Thank you. There we go. It's hard to spell on the board.
Yes.
Okay, so we got those. Now we're going to just, those will be the background for our discussion today. We're going to talk about them all over. Okay. Before we launch into more sin, we're going to go over these. And for some of you, this is a repeat or a reinforcer would be the pedagogical term for it. One of the important things that we need to know before we talk about what feminist theology says about sin, we need to be clear, reasonably clear, on what feminist theology is. And feminist theology really arose as an independent approach to theology really in the 60s. And at the same time, we see the rise of what was called black theology. Now we have Asian theology, we have Mujerista theology, we have gay lesbian theology. And what it is, the easiest way for me to demonstrate this is to recall, if anyone saw the movie Dead Poets Society, remember when Robin Williams makes the kids stand up on the desk? And it looks really cool in the movie, and y'all think, oh, I want to do that. Because they see things from a different perspective. They see things they've never seen before. And the perspective that feminist theology takes is that the first 1900 years of theology were written largely by educated males who had a lot of privilege. And they saw the world, and they thought the world existed as they saw it. And feminist theologians and black theologians, theologians of liberation come along and say, you know, from over here where I stand, things look a little bit different. And that's what we're going to talk about today with sin. Okay? So feminist theology, a nice way to present it is with these seven themes. Okay? And think of these as not either or, but as emphasis or balance, if you want to think of a pendulum or if you want to think of a scale. One of the first themes is immanence over transcendence. So rather than emphasizing God as, say, like Tom up in the balcony, far away, God is right here in the world, okay, concerned about the world, radically interactive with the world. And this makes you nervous. One way to think about it that I find very helpful is to think that if you think about the encounter between the Israelites and God, God was radically present, radically concerned, jealous, repenting, involved. So God being radically imminent in the world, it's not a new concept. What happened is we tended to emphasize transcendence coming from Greco-Roman thought rather than what the Old Testament tells us about God's passion for the world. Second, when feminists think about God, they want to think about God as a being in relation rather than a substance. And again, this is an idea here, this color, where what a source for this idea really is coming from Greek philosophy, okay? And our first theologians were trained in Greek philosophy. And feminists want to say, no, God is being in relationship. Okay, that's what makes us people, is being in relationship. And so that's an emphasis. The next, when talking about God, is that, again, instead of the Greek ideal of no change, immutability, that God watches the world like this and says, it's mildly interesting what's going on down there. No, God changes. My friend Joan, I've said this three times this week, says if you want to look this up in a concordance, look up repent and how many times God repents. So God does change. God does react to what happens here in creation. A fourth point is that rather than emphasizing a focus on what's heaven going to be like and what will my spiritual body be like and who will I know and when will I see my grandmother and will we get along in heaven, feminists are asking questions about what can we do to liberate people from systems of oppression here on earth. And always think of feminist theology as being part of a larger body of liberation theology. Another emphasis, instead of thinking about eschatology, logos talk about the last things, feminists want to talk about ecology. What can we do to save the earth now? Because if we don't, we're going to blow it up. Two more points. Instead of emphasizing the authority of the tradition, feminist theology wants to talk about the authority of your experience with God. The experience that you have had, either mundane or radically revelatory, but your experience. And finally, and this is true of many disciplines now as we look to the new millennium, but instead of saying, I am this educated man and I'm going to write this theology and it's going to apply to you and you and you and you and you, no, feminist theologians say, all my theology is shaped by my context. I could go and live in Peru for 90 years until I died there, but I would always be an affluent, white, upper middle class, educated US American citizen. I could never free myself from those parts of my context, so they impact theology. And then, now it gets even more exciting, feminists take all these principles and try to do three tasks. And this is what we're going to do today. They look through the tradition, we're going to look at sin, and they say, you know, maybe there's more than two choices for women. Maybe we don't have to be either the Blessed Virgin or the evil temptress Eve. So they look through the tradition, and they critique it, and they ask questions in protest. Then they start digging, and they say, wow, look at all these great women saints. Look at all these egalitarian Christian communities that existed in the New Testament. And they retrieve them, and names come up that we've never heard before that have been in the Bible the whole time. Finally, they create some new stuff. They make new stuff up, new theological ideas. So those are the seven themes and the three tasks, and it's a really short introduction, but I hope it kind of gives you a sense for that shift of balance. Before we talk about sin, does anybody have any questions about this? Everybody's dying to sin. Okay. Great. What we're going to do now is, let's see. Does anybody out there have a Bible? I have a little one. If somebody could grab one for me and just read some, I'll tell you what to read. What we're going to do now is I'm going to briefly talk about the doctrine of sin as it's been understood in the Bible. We're going to just skip through Augustine and a little bit of Luther, because there's some Lutherans in the room, and then talk about a little bit about Reinhold Niebuhr. Doesn't this picture look exciting? Okay, this is Mr. Sin in the 20th century. Okay, so we're going to talk about him, and then we're going to do what the feminists are now saying. Okay, sin has generally been understood as two things: either a condition into which we are born. We are Adam's seed, okay? Or as things that I do, like if I walked over and hit you, I wish I wouldn't do it because you did such a good job reading the other day. But two things, okay? Now in the Bible, there's about, if you kind of break it into broad generalizations, there's kind of four different images of sin that come up. The first is the story of the fall and Adam and Eve. And here, this is really important. You don't remember much else I say tonight, remember this. Sin is portrayed as pride or disobedience, okay? Pride or disobedience. If you want to use the big word, you can say concupiscence, meaning desire. That's the original sin, okay? Adam and Eve wanted to be like God, and that's why they went for the fruit. Okay, so sin is pride. And that is generally, if you wanted to condense the tradition, sin as pride is it. That's been the root sin. We have a tree of life. If you were going to imagine a tree of sin, the roots would be the sins of pride. Okay. The second way sin has been presented in the Bible is, Paul does this, is as a power or a force in history and the human person that keeps us in bondage. And if whoever has that Bible could read Romans 7, I now hear turning of pages, Romans 7, 15 to 18. And while you look at that, I'll move on to a few other points. Jesus taught new ways of understanding sin. Okay, instead of just breaking the covenant or breaking the purity codes, sin was, Matthew 23, religious hypocrisy. Okay, we all remember Jesus preaching about that. Matthew 25, Luke 19, the use of our talents, the failure to use our God-given talents, be interpreted as sin. Matthew 5:28, if you commit adultery in your heart, it's still a sin. These are all new understandings of sin. And finally, Matthew 25 or Luke 16, sin was violating or exploiting another person. Okay. And now let's go to the Romans text. And again, this is sin as a power or force that holds us in bondage. Romans 7:15 through 18.
I do not understand my own actions, for I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate. Now, if I do what I do not want, I agree that the law is good. But in fact, it is no longer I that do it, but sin that dwells within me. For I know that nothing good dwells within me that is in my flesh. I can will what is right, but I cannot do it.
Okay, and we all know that feeling, whether it's that person at work or that person in the family, you think, I should do this, I should do this, I should do this, and then when the moment comes, you don't do what you think is the right thing to do. That sense of trapped. Even in the Lutheran, the old Red Book said, We are by nature sinful and unclean. And the Green Book says we are in bondage to sin and cannot free ourselves. Okay, so we even in our own small Lutheran tradition see a shift in the language between by nature sinful and unclean and bondage. And this bondage is very Pauline. Okay, so you got those couple options floating in the Bible. Now, when you want to talk about sin, you've got to talk about Augustine. There's just no getting around him. We talked about him yesterday. He doesn't exactly have a high place for women in his anthropology either. Augustine understood sin as disordered will. So we've got this will, we've got this love, but it's not quite ordered, and it should be ordered to God. Okay, but instead it gets ordered to the flesh. It gets ordered to our desires. It gets ordered to our passions. Okay, and Eve, because Eve was closer to nature, fleshier, hotter. Eve is closer to nature, was considered more able to fall into temptation than Adam. She is the one who tempted man into sin. And another way to understand Augustine's understanding of sin is, if you want to think of it as pride, pride is trying to be like God. You can also think of it in terms of transcendence, that Adam and Eve, in the second account, were trying to be like God. They were trying to transcend their creaturely status, okay? My right relationship with God is to say, I am God's beautiful creature, and my job is to be that creature. As soon as I try to be like God, that's pride, that's sin. Okay, so that's a very small nutshell understanding of Augustine. You can also think of it, if you're having trouble getting your head around that, as literally, I'll make you God. I keep forgetting your name. What's your name?
John.
John is God, okay? Now, if my relationship with God is ordered correctly, I'm facing John. Now, if I have a disordered will, I've literally turned away from God, okay? So that's another, if you like visual images, that's another way to think of what Augustine was trying to express, is this disorientation to ourselves rather than to God. Now, Luther was an Augustinian monk. Okay, so that plays a really important part. That's why Lutherans like to talk about sin and why we still take it seriously. I recently did a lot of work on hymns, and I was comparing hymns in UCC, United Methodist, Episcopal, Gather, and the Green Book has a lot about sin in there, more than most hymnals. And some of the older ones from the 20s and 30s that my folks had are just scary on sin. So it's a very important part of our tradition. Luther took sin very seriously. He believed in original sin as inherited, and that it's an inescapable part of our existence. Okay, we can't get out of it. It's not in our nature, but it's just, it's like one of those science fiction movies where the brown ooze goes over the guy. You just can't, no matter what you do, or the blob in the 50s, you just can't get out of it, okay? Luther did say some new things about sin. One was, he said, we can only know the depth of our sin in light of the gospel. It's the grace of God and the gospel that helps us see it. In fact, I wish Marcia was here, but memory is that at one point he even said that were we to know our own sin without the grace of the gospel, we'd literally die. We couldn't bear it. Okay. A second thing is important about Luther is that he interpreted the primary or root sin as sin against the first commandment. Pride, self-satisfaction, lack of trust in God. So he's very much in continuity with Augustine, okay? So keep having this pride tape rolling in the background. And finally, another thing that Luther did that was really interesting was sins against the neighbor were of central importance in Luther's thought. And we talked about the text in Matthew 25 and Luke 16, where Jesus talks about sin as exploiting the other person or violating the other person. And the concern for the neighbor was a driving force in Luther's theology, and we see it here too. Okay. So now we're going to make a really huge leap to this century, and we're going to talk about Reinhold Niebuhr. You don't really need to remember this name, but you may choose to. And these are The Nature and Destiny of Man, Volumes 1 and 2. They're available in the Holden Library, where I checked them out. I was hoping I wouldn't have to haul mine up here. And Niebuhr delivered some very famous lectures that served as the basis of these books. And what was going on for Niebuhr was really interesting. In light of World War I, the Great Depression, and World War II, prior to those events, there had been this great belief in human achievement. There will be no more wars. You know, there will be no more famine. We're going to achieve world peace, and industry and technology is going to get us there. Well, Niebuhr started to say, you know, in light of these events, it's obvious those things aren't happening. Why? And he started to try to understand human nature and the human person. And he was an ardent defender of the doctrine of sin and an original sin in light of the tragedies of the beginning of this century. Sin is natural for people, humans, he said man, in the sense that it is universal, but it is not necessary. So again, he's trying to say what Luther said and Augustine. We're created good, but we're trapped in this. It's like a heavy, if you've ever had a heavy, wet wool coat on, just that oppressive feeling that we're trapped in it. And Niebuhr's doctrine of sin fell into two categories. One is sin as, and you all know what this word can be, pride. The other is sin as, sin, now you all may be nervous about spelling, sin as sensuality. Did I get that right?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Okay, sin as pride is pretty much what we've been talking about. It's a disordered will. It's trying to transcend our creaturely status, to be like God. And it's really interesting because then on the other side over here, sin is sensuality. He used this example of, and I'll draw it very poorly, but of a sailor up in the crow's nest on a ship. And I wouldn't want to be up there in a storm. I get seasick going to the dentist, so I would be the worst person to do that. But this feeling of total anxiety, okay? And that's what he's really calling sensuality. Okay, sin is sensuality is also following our impulses and attaching ourselves to something that is less than God. Okay, so again, it's real similar. Here's John. John is God. God is John. So for Niebuhr, instead of attaching myself to God, I'm attaching myself to an ice cream cone or to popcorn in the pool hall or to TV or game board or whatever. But it's that same sense of the person turning, okay, away from God. All right. Another part of this that's really interesting with the sailor and the crow's nest is that Niebuhr says, you know, being in the crow's nest like that, that's just how it is, folks. That's the human condition. And remember I said before that we have to accept our creaturely status? Accepting that anxiety is part of the creaturely status. That's one of the things Niebuhr was trying to get across. So he has these two ideas, but I should have drawn this and then made this really teeny, because you took all of what he said on sin. This was all pride, and this is going to be part of the feminist critique. And this was what he did with the sin of sensuality. Okay, let me just make sure I haven't skipped anything here. Another important part is that Niebuhr is, again, right in continuity with Luther and Augustine. The root sin is pride or disobedience, failing to accept our creaturely status. Okay. Before I move on to the feminist response to this, I want to see if just there's any questions about content, if there's anything I said that somebody wants clarified. Pretty meaty. I mean, we all sin, but it's something else to see it up here on the board. Nothing? Okay. So now, the easiest way to do this is to say that there are several points that feminist theologians have in common, and then I'm going to introduce you to two or three thinkers, depending upon how time flies. Okay, the first one is
and this has come up in the last two sessions and will come up in the next two, is to reject dualistic thinking. And by that, that means that feminist theologians want to get rid of this idea that, that the spirit is good and the flesh is bad. Okay, they want to get rid of that dualism. So no more of that. Okay, so that's the first point. A second point that all the theologians that we're going to talk about tonight accept is that Eve as first sinner has been used as an oppressive tool. Okay, and I don't think anybody in this room would argue with that.
Okay.
That throughout history, the association with women, with Eve, has been used to keep women down. Okay. A fourth point is that all these, that all these theologians are going to reject the way that women have been called the first to sin and the cause of sin. It's this great quote by Tertullian I had to work in here. He writes about women, or of women, "You are the devil's gateway. You are the unsealer of that forbidden tree. You are the first deserter of the divine law. You are she who persuaded him whom the devil was not valiant enough to attack. You destroyed so easily God's image man. On account of your desert, that is your death, even the Son of God had to die." Okay, so that's a lot.
Wow.
That's a pretty heavy burden. Okay? And if you think that this quote by Tertullian was one that nobody knew of for 2,000 years, you're wrong. Because he just comes up again and again and again. Okay, now we're going to get right to the heart of it, which is, if you wanted to say the bulwark, the majority of the feminist critique, which I think now would be number four, is to challenge the very concept of sin as pride as the root sin. Okay, and that's really what we're going to be talking about. There's a great quote by Marjorie Suhaki. She's at Claremont in California. And one of the reasons she wants to get rid of sin as pride is, and I love this, all her stuff, just her stuff always gets down to the human factor. And she says, sin as pride isn't adequate to, quote, account for the enormity and variety of ways by which we manage to inflict ill-being upon ourselves, one another, and our environing earth. And what she's saying is, this isn't helping us anymore. Okay, it just doesn't work. It oppresses women. It's bad for the environment because it's all based again on, you see me draw this triangle, a lot. God, man, woman, kids, slaves, animals, earth. Okay, it's all based on a hierarchical model. One last thing I'll say before we move into Valerie Saving's work is it's really interesting which feminists like to keep original sin and which don't. Some feminist theologians think it's been so harmful for women, it has no redeeming value in the tradition. We should just get rid of it entirely. And especially since it's hard to separate original sin from the act of conception. Okay, and feminists definitely want to get rid of that because it makes the body dirty, it makes sex dirty, it makes anything having to do with your erogenous zones dirty automatically. Okay, other feminists like Marjorie Suhaki and Mary Potter Engel believe that we should retain the concept of original sin, but we need to disassociate it from this transmission of the first sin through intercourse. And instead, they want to keep the category to just acknowledge the scope and the breadth and the depth of sin. So it's an interesting question, and I haven't made my own commitment yet, so we'll see if you all can help me make that tonight.
Okay.
Yeah.
I miss how the sin of pride oppresses women. That seemed like a quantum leap from...
Well, we're about to get to it. If you could just wait 5 minutes,
We're
going to get to that. What we're going to do is unpack why these feminist thinkers think that the sin of pride, and maybe the word oppressed might not be the best word to use, but let me give it a try. And in 10 minutes, if you still have a question, we'll go then. Okay, so it's 1960. A theologian named Valerie Saving wrote an article, which actually lay unread for many, many years. And basically what Saving said is that defining the human condition of sin as pride has excluded half of the population. What she's saying is that the sin of pride is really a sin that men commit, for lack of a better word. What she says is that the sin for women, instead of overassertion and pride and I'm going to be up here high and I'm going to be closer to God, okay, and I'm going to turn away from God, that the sin for women is self-negation, lack of self-esteem. It's the exact opposite. And I'm going to read her quote from her now. For the temptation of woman as woman, for the temptation of women, sorry, as woman, are not the same as the temptations of man as man. And the specifically feminine forms of sin have a quality which can never be encompassed by such terms as pride and will to power. They're better suggested by such terms as triviality, distractibility, and diffusiveness. So if you want to think of it this way, okay, traditionally we've got this umbrella, our sin as pride umbrella, okay? And there's lots of different things that could put under there, and many of them we listed here. But what Saving is saying is that, and it's interesting here because now we're going to look at this again. Anxiety. Maybe we could write up here lack of self. Lack all, that would be one. Lack of self-esteem would be another. And rather than overasserting oneself as a creature, you could write, there's no short way to write this, failing to accept oneself, I'm running out of ink, as God's beautiful creation, okay? So what Saving is saying, sorry, this pen isn't working better.
What's your name?
Saving, S-A-I-V-I-N-G. What she's saying is that these sins of lack of self, they don't fit under this umbrella. So it's not so much a question of oppression as that naming sin as pride is really naming sin from a male experience and saying that it applies to everyone. And what Saving's saying is it really applies to men. Okay? Thank you. I'm just making sure I don't have anything else here. Absolutely positive. Okay. Are people, are you starting to get a sense for this? I will really, if you're not with me now, you're going to lose me. So I want to make sure that everybody's with me. Do you get a sense of what her critique is? Okay. All right. So then the next, looking at my watch here, the next position.
One of the things I found very helpful is going back to the Genesis 1 image,
okay,
where Genesis 1 says that male and female were created in God's image.
Right.
And what this sin is the women's side refusing to see themselves
absolutely
as fully created in God's image. Mm-hmm. And
absolutely.
So male becomes assertive and fully God's image, and female somehow less than that.
Right.
So it's a negation of God's originally act in creation.
Mm-hmm. And we talked about the two stories yesterday. And that's, you know, what Dan just said is what I'm trying to get at here with this. I haven't found a short way to say it. That's what I need. But failing to accept oneself as God's beautiful creation. Okay.
Could you also be saying here?
Sorry, John, I didn't
that,
see you.
That women haven't had the power to try to be God.
That I think the power analysis is a really interesting way to form the question. Does everybody kind of understand what John's saying? That you have to have power to assert yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and if I understood you correctly, if you're powerless, the sin of asserting power is not going to be a problem for you. Okay, so that's a really good point. A second position that's been, I want to make sure we have plenty of time. Was there a hand?
Then is the contention that if a woman gets into a place of power, she will not become prideful and lord it over others? Or are gender, are we immune to pride, or is it is it the context that we're in and the culture that we're in? Is it gender based or contextual that some are more prone toward pridefulness than others to self-negation?
Well, this is an absolutely excellent question, and we talked about a similar question yesterday, and the example I used was that, I don't know who it was Jeff and Judy. Here they are again. Okay, there's Jeff and there's Judy. All right, now here's, and let's say that Jeff and Judy, I mean, it's the whole brain, body, nature, nurture discussion. Okay, whether or not, this is what I think most feminists, at least probably, I would really probably not want to speak for a lot of these people, but if they were here, this is what I think they would say. What I think they would say is, Jeff and Judy, if they were raised in some sort of insular little place, maybe like Golden Village, maybe they would exhibit, Judy would be full of pride and Jeff would be full of anxiety. But the reality is that the larger culture, and it's just what you hit at, that the larger culture so shapes our gender roles that it's not wrong to say, to make these generalizations. Does that help at all? Kind of clarify?
I understand.
Okay, and I don't think, I certainly feel confident saying that none of these women are going to say, oh no, women don't have this in pride. But what they're saying is, again, always think of these as emphases. And what women are trying to say is that they've been ignored in the sin debate. And the categories of pride hasn't worked for them. It's not naming their sin. And if we think of it from a pastoral perspective, I think it's really interesting. Because if you go into your congregation and you're preaching about sin as pride and sin as self-satisfaction and sin as misuse of power, you're not speaking to half your congregation. So there are really powerful pastoral implications for this, too.
It seems like the real gift of this feminist critique is that it opens up for us the whole concept of sin. So the umbrella, if you will, catches those men, too, who have been outside the pride umbrella.
Right.
It critique is that it's a whole new perspective that women have brought.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it... I think finally it just opens up the concept of sin.
It's like going from a little travel umbrella to a golf umbrella.
There you go.
Trying to get this too many, but I think it's even more beyond just missing half your congregation. If you see sin only as pride, you end up reinforcing the very dynamics that keep women or African Americans or whatever in positions of subordination.
Right.
And so that's part of, because if we can, so if a woman begins to say, no, I have equal rights and stuff, and say, oh, that's just being pride, you know, it puts the already underprivileged back in their place.
And that's an excellent segue, not planned, but excellent, into the next person we're going to talk about. Some of you may have read some of her material before, Mary Potter Engel. And she has an essay called Evil, Sin, and Violation of the Vulnerable. And she takes a whole new perspective. Okay, remember I said, okay, here, let's say we've got a huddle, and in this huddle is Augustine and neighbor Luther, and they're huddling up on pride. And then we have Saving and another woman, Judith Plasko, who we didn't go into tonight, and they're saying, no, sin is more a lack of self. There's another woman, Susan Dunphy, who says that for women, sin is the sin of hiding. Okay, that's her primary category, okay? And now we're going to talk about one more position, which I think is fascinating, and that's Mary Potter Engel's. And she has a new position. Okay, so she's over here. And her position is, she's saying, how does the doctrine of sin function for women who have been victims of physical and sexual abuse? It's a new position. And remember I said, theology is about asking questions from different places. Okay. And what Engel is trying to do is investigate and reconceive the doctrine of sin for survivors of domestic and sexual abuse. What is labeled, and this is really important, this is the key, what is labeled sin in the theological tradition actually function as survival tactics for victims of abuse. Okay? And that gets right back to what Dan was saying, and I'm going to talk about that a little more. An example of that is, traditionally, anger has been viewed as a sin. You know, half the people in this room are probably Midwest descent. I mean, what's worse that you can do in Minnesota than get angry at somebody? So traditionally, anger has been viewed as a sin. But for victims, anger is an important part of maintaining one's identity, recognizing the abusive situation, and beginning to free oneself from it. Okay? So it's a perfect example of how this category doesn't work for everybody. sin as pride, of saying, you know what? I am God's beautiful creation, and you can't beat the crap out of me every night when you come home. And I'm angry about that. That's not a sin for this woman in this situation, even though this traditional model would say it is. Okay? So the pastoral implications of this are really, really powerful. And Engel has several proposals. Instead of anger, which is good for victims, she proposes that we think of sin as a distortion of feeling, okay? And she also points out how we are guilty of the sin of being numb. All of us, okay? Instead of disobedience, which is a pretty, you know, it's always listed up there, especially with kids. Think about what Marcia's been talking about this week. Instead of disobedience, she proposes that we replace disobedience as a sin and think of sin as a betrayal of trust. And again, if we think of that from the victim's perspective, when the abuse happens, it is a betrayal of trust. You love me, I love you, this should be a safe place. It's not a safe place. You have broken this trust, or trust being broken in a relationship. She also says, instead of sin as pride or self-love, she proposes that we think of sin as a distortion of the boundaries of the self, okay? And again, if you think of this from the perspective of someone who's in an abusive situation, it's a violation of boundaries. It's a violation of boundaries, okay? To hit someone is to treat them as an object, as less than God's beautiful creation, to violate boundaries. And finally, she says, instead of sin as concupiscence, she prefers to think of sin in terms of distorted relationships, okay? So I don't know where she would fit here on the umbrella, but what she's saying again is that pride isn't working, and that we need to think, if I was going to summarize her approach in one word, it would probably be, sin as broken relationships and boundaries, okay? And it's fascinating when you get into her writing, she even talks about how sin is different for the abuser than it is for the victim, and that the pastoral approach should be different. And what's appropriate for the victim, anger, is not appropriate for the abuser. It's fascinating, fascinating stuff. It is 9:45, and I want to do one thing with this. It'll take about 2 minutes, and then I really want to have lots of time to talk, because there's a big meeting here at 7, and we will be herded out quite quickly by the staff. So what I want to do is, let me get another board back up here. Is now, in light of what the things that we wrote down on the umbrella, let's put some, if you were going to think of sin, let's see, sin, let's call it sin beyond pride, okay? And we're thinking of some of the things that Saving and Engel have talked about. The closest one that are there any up here, let me ask you, in black, that you think fall outside the pride umbrella? That maybe sins of hiding or sins of lack of self? Or have you stayed, or have you learned something about yourself by seeing that these all fall within the umbrella? You see what I'm asking? Dan?
Well, some of those I can see of having either one, because I think sometimes passive-aggressive behavior is one of the things that comes out of this one here. So things like lying or deceit, or they can be survival mechanisms, but they can also come out of distorted relationship where you're coming from a place of powerlessness.
Okay. So maybe...
And sloth could be, too, in the sense that it's sort of...
Okay.
Backing totally away.
Okay. Well, let's think of some sins that would definitely be up here. Let's set that aside for a minute. Okay? We've talked about it already. Sin as, you're going to say, and you can think of concrete situations. You can think of everyday events. When we fail to do this.
Okay? Lack of self-worth.
Okay, great. What would be another one?
Codependency.
Okay.
Ooh, it's the 90s.
I guess that was the 80s. All right. Triviality.
No, I said
that. Okay.
Denial.
denial of gifts, one's gifts.
Ah, there we go. We're back to Jesus now. Well, we are.
Yes.
I mean, that's what he said. We're hiding our talents, okay?
Numbness.
Good. Okay, I'm going to put up hiding.
Silence.
A biggie.
Apathy.
Submissiveness to invalid authorities.
Okay.
Submissiveness to invalid authority.
Yeah, but that's how you define pride before. Well, this is a complicated one. I think I know where you're going. I could go either way. I mean, there's no perfect line between these, but I think it's interesting that it tells us something that many of these, this is about taking more than we deserve. This is about eating more than we deserve, being more than we deserve, taking something that doesn't belong to us, taking someone that doesn't belong to us, killing someone that doesn't belong to us, false god. This one is kind of an either or, like Dan was saying. Wanting something that we shouldn't be wanting. This is kind of in there. But we can see here that when I asked you 40 minutes ago to talk about sin, most of these fall under the pride umbrella, okay? And if this session doesn't do anything for you, I hope it will help you expand your understanding of what sin might be, okay? Because, like I said before, the pastoral implications of this are really, really important. And now I'm going to stop talking and take questions and discussion and all that. Yes?
Well, I just said to my sister, well, then I'm really living in sin because, you know, how can this be helpful to me as a woman to see even more of my life is what is called sin?
Okay.
I mean,
that's a really good question. Does anybody?
Did I make myself?
You made. Did everybody understand that question? Mm-hmm. Is it just heaping more stuff on top of you?
Yeah.
More sins that you could feel
because
bad for at the end of the day.
I can identify with so many of those. Then.
Okay. More so than these?
Yes.
That's interesting too. What, Mary, were you going
to
say something?
That's it. I think because you are able to identify with those, there's something about that you're naming.
So I think what Mary's trying to say is that you're naming your reality, and from that is knowledge and insight. Not that they go away, but that now you know what they are, rather than feeling like, oh, I don't really do any of this. So I don't know, I'd love to hear more suggestions on that. Susan, and then Dan, and then Dave.
It seems to me that the red takes sin seriously, and the feminist critique is that pride simply was an umbrella that didn't name the sins of half the population. The flip side of that is, if you can name your sin, how do you know when forgiveness has come,
mm-hmm,
and
yes,
that grace abounds?
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me the first reaction, you look at that list and say, like, gosh, there's my life up here. But the grace of it is now that my life has been named,
mm-hmm,
there's hope for me not to continue,
mm-hmm,
in this way. There is,
mm-hmm,
then the future is opened up to me,
right,
the way it hadn't been opened up,
mm-hmm,
before. So it doesn't seem to me that the end all and be all is to be able to name sins. It's to be able to name the truth about our lives so that we can receive the gift,
mm-hmm,
of the future God opens to us.
And that's really consistent with what I said before about what was new for Luther with sin, which was we can only know sin through the grace of God. Because if we saw it without that, we'd just be crushed. I'm going to take Dave and then Dan.
I really appreciate your visual ways of sharing with us today, because I think that really does cinch up a lot. I kind of think about it in terms of if you've been dealing with a category of sin that doesn't apply to you, I imagine just like a lot of people, most people, you sit there and wonder, geez, when are they going to talk to me? Or better yet, you're probably thinking, when am I going to understand this stuff? And in a way, I think about a visual compass.
Hmm.
And finally, you get a compass for your life,
mm-hmm,
in terms of what is leading you or what is your direction.
Mm-hmm. And I think another thing to keep in mind, too, is that what Dan mentioned before, which is if you think of power as a bucket of water, okay, and if there's a fire, if I can't if there's nothing in my bucket, if I don't have any pride at all, if I don't have any power. So what these feminists are saying is, this category of pride as power, as overassertion, just isn't working. And I think Susan's take on it from the pastoral perspective is really powerful, because then you can see things as they really are. And that's part of the gift of the gospel. Dan?
I guess this is a bigger caveat on what both Susan and Dave were saying. And this is where, for me, Paul's image of being in bondage to sin, or sin is actually having this power, is so powerful when I look at that list, because I don't look at it from prison of women, but I particularly think many gay and lesbian people, these are the issues that we struggle with so much, that whole sense of lack of self-worth, and at times it just feels like it's so deeply embedded in us that we'll never come over, But then what Susan's talking about in terms of the radicality of the gift of grace, of forgiveness, of God's inbreaking salvation is that much more clear when you're saying Luther's point on that. But there is something about when you recognize yourself in it, it can feel so overwhelming because it is so part of who we are.
Right.
And yet the promise of the gospel is that's precisely where God is present breaking through that.
And also keep in mind the emphasis that even as awful as some of the stuff was that Augustine said, it was that we're in bondage to sin. Okay, think of the difference between the red book and the green book. We're in bondage to sin and cannot free ourselves. It's not that we are by nature sinful and unclean. Okay, another hand. One, two.
I'm getting lost in the categories here. The things, what Augustine is doing when he had listed pride as a root sin, is he was, where is the source of all sin? He spent time talking about the clutching of an infant for its mother, and suddenly the infant would get furious. You know, I'm not getting what I want right now.
Mm-hmm.
And he would see that as in the smallest of ways, there's the beginning. That's what I'm talking about.
Right.
Is that concupiscence wasn't sinful, or was it sexual desire? It was just clutching.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side, with what you're talking about, is that the root sin is the failure to, and then my eyes fade out.
Well, so does the pen. What we were talking about over here was hiding, or selflessness, lack of self-esteem, or failing to accept oneself as God's beautiful creation.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking less of the self rather than thinking too much of the self.
And I think the way he would talk about pride, so he wouldn't simply just label it as assertion. And everything that's on that list over there, and everything that's on that list, I can view in terms of this disordered relationship with God. Mm-hmm. Even the infant has some kind of disorder. Was
okay.
Fury. I'm not getting the milk right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm feeling some pain. And every one of those things over there is, I'm going to hide because I don't trust. I'm going to go numb because I don't trust. I'm going to deny these gifts. I'm codependent. I'm et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so in that sense, the feminist critique may lack some punch.
Okay. Well, the only real response I could give you in the 4 seconds we have left is, I think the one thing I would say is that you're absolutely right. I agree with what you said about Augustine. However, what I would say is that the way Augustine's theology has functioned and has been interpreted in the majority of the Christian tradition is sin as pride. The nuances that you understand have not been there. And especially when we look at Niebuhr, what Niebuhr was talking about was pride. And that is, Niebuhr and Nigrin and Tillich were some of the contemporary thinkers that these women were
responding to. I guess that's the trouble I'm having. I spent 2 or 3 years reading Augustine, not as a theologian or a professional, but simply as the man who brought me to faith.
Right.
And when I hear all these things, I'm hearing artificial categories that are being, when I read him, there's incredible nuances that are, they're just beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And then I hear artificial splits where the whole theology is built on the fact, well, pride doesn't work. And
I don't think anybody's saying pride doesn't work. What they're saying is that pride doesn't work for everybody. Okay? Pride doesn't work for women.
Okay, and I really feel like I need to get to somebody else's question too, because we really only have just a few minutes left. So do you have any questions?
I've never seen this. This is powerful for me. These sins here are the sins that we receive that have been imposed upon people, that women have been told that they lack self-worth. Somebody has to do that to someone else. Mm-hmm. That's how I see the list. Somebody has to tell the gay person that they're not whole and complete. Mm-hmm. So that I don't see how that comes from a person. I see that as imposed. While the sins over here, be it called masculine sins, can also be positive, like pride under good regulation
right. Is
a good thing.
Right.
Gluttony, well, I'm worth it to eat that one last piece of cake. Or I deserve, you know, I need that, so I'm going to take it because I deserve it. Or some of the other ones, even murder, you know, justification of murder or lust. Yeah, yeah.
Well,
I look at all of those as can be positive, but these are always negative, always imposed on people.
Well, that's an interesting observation. And I don't know if anybody else would see that or not. One more hand, and then I think we really should stop.
Well, it's going to open up too much. I'll ask it here.
Well, then I've got time for one more question. Yes. Ruth?
I was just going to say, as from pastoral implications, as I look at a situation that is clearly unhealthy and unbalanced, to be able as a pastor to say to typically the woman, mm-hmm. you are in a state of sin mm-hmm. by doing this, mm-hmm. to be able then for them to be able to lift themselves out to repent mm-hmm. and to turn, to orient their life towards God in a new way. Mm-hmm. That's a powerful mm-hmm. mechanism and takes it out of the psychosocial babble that they can get anywhere.
Right, and it does
help them see it in relationship mm-hmm. to God. And so I agree with him that all of these can be found, these nuances can be found if you read Augustine mm-hmm. in the purest form. But how many of us do that?
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be an either or situation.
No, and remember what I said at the beginning, that feminist theology is trying to retrieve and revive, and also to emphasize things that have been underemphasized and to hear voices that have not been heard. It's not that these feminists are saying sin is pride doesn't work. They're just saying there's a lot of other ways we can understand this that include the other half of the population.
Yeah.
So I feel like I need to close to respect the time for the staff so we can get to Vespers and everything. So thank you very much.